Coming up on this week's book show, for 7 years, journalist and New Yorker writer Eliza Griswold reported and wrote the story of how fracking in southwestern Pennsylvania's Marcellus Shale forever altered the lives of Stacey Haney and her family. Griswold's book, Amity and Prosperity, One Family and the Fracturing of America, just received the Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction. Eliza Griswold on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. For 7 years, journalist and New Yorker writer Eliza Griswold reported and wrote the story of how fracking in southwestern Pennsylvania's Marcellus Shale forever altered the lives of Stacey Haney, her daughter, and her son. In April, Griswold's book, Amity and Prosperity, One Family and the Fracturing of America, received the Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction. It is now out in paperback. When a fracking drill site opens near her home in Amity, Pennsylvania, local nurse and single mother Stacey Haney becomes an unlikely activist. With the help of neighbors and a husband and wife legal team, she begins to investigate what's really in the water and air, pursuing a court case that begins to expose the damage that's being done to the land and to her family. It is a great pleasure to welcome Eliza Griswold to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, the name of the book, Amity and Prosperity, One Family of the Fracturing of America. I will begin by congratulating you on the Pulitzer Prize. I assume anyone who wins that is a surprise.
That is quite a surprise. That's a jaw dropper.
Do you think it says something about us as people of what we are now interested in, what is on our radar?
You know, I guess, and I'm sure every writer would say this, I found it heartening because the book's pretty quiet.
Right.
You know, it is not like of the moment, all over the place. And it's not only a quiet way of writing, but I think the story itself is about sort of the daily horrors that so many rural Americans live with as they pay for the energy appetites of urban Americans. So I was heartened that the judges would see in this the merit of a prize of that size.
How did you initially come upon the story?
You know, many years ago, in March of 2011, I was reporting on infrastructure. The book really began in northern Nigeria, funnily enough, when a bridge collapsed many years ago. I was reporting my first book, and I had to get across a river on an oil barrel, on an empty oil barrel, as you do as a reporter. And it was a couple of weeks after I-35W had collapsed into Minneapolis.
Right.
And 13 people had died. And there was something about that that made me really want to come back to the United States and explore our collective poverty, like how we don't invest in our lifeline systems over time, and infrastructure, bridges and roads are one example of that. So I set out for southwestern Pennsylvania because of the sheer number of crumbling bridges there, started reporting on locks and levees and dams, things I really did not know very much about, and met this amazing biologist named Rose Riley, who studied water. And she was the one who said, you know what, you better come with me to Morgantown, West Virginia, to meet people who are dealing with this new kind of gas drilling called fracking. And they are the farmers who are living with these well sites on their land, and they're talking about it. So I went with her, took the hour-long drive from Pittsburgh down to Morgantown, West Virginia, to really meet people. And Stacey Haney was one of the people speaking. For the first time she'd spoken in public was that day.
And what was it about her that had you zero in on her and her story?
It was how careful she was with fact. You know, she was not interested in being written about, especially when it comes to fracking, because it's become such a political football. people who've suffered a great deal have also become polarized in a way that I don't know is helpful to really exploring the reality, both political, historical, and scientific. And Stacy was a nurse. She was very careful with fact. She didn't want to be written about. You know, she was not looking for a big publicity moment from anybody. Also, I would say it was her integrity standing up and saying what she knew and saying what she didn't know that made me think, you know, this is somebody whose story bears deeper exploration. I wasn't sure. She didn't know at that time exactly what had happened. She knew that there were benzene and toluene in her and her kids' bodies. She knew her son, who was 14, had gotten arsenic poisoning. Mm-hmm. She knew this gas site was behind a high fence a few hundred feet from her house. She knew their water had turned black. She knew their animals were dying. But in terms of like causal link, she didn't know exactly what was sickening them.
One of the things that you point out here is that it's easy to say, well, this wasn't here 10 years ago and things were okay. Now this is here and things aren't. We can maybe assume that that's the reason. It's proving it that is so difficult.
It's proving it that's so difficult. And this is where I think journalism really plays a role in being careful. I think we see so much these days about fake news and opinion masquerading as fact on both sides. Mm-hmm. And in that way, Stacy and I were really both very committed to making sure things were accurate. And where you cannot establish a causal link, you don't. The story I have on the page so often where the limits of fact can be established, I'll tell you the limits are there. I'm not interested in putting on top some sort of story that can't be proven.
What were her warning signs in the sense of as the sicknesses came that she started to put it all together? Because she becomes really the reporter in this of tracking down her veterinary bills, her medical bills, and looking and seeing what was at the bottom of those.
She and her neighbor, Beth Voiles, were standing at a county fair where they are committed to their animals in a way that for me as an outsider was hard to grasp at first. I mean, their animals are like children in their families, both of these families, their neighbors. And so they were at the county fair showing animals, and they had a conversation by the lemonade stand about the death of a one-year-old boxer puppy that belonged to Beth Voiles. And that was the beginning of thinking Beth had seen the puppy drinking what turned out to be fracking wastewater, most likely on the roadside, and definitely water sprayed from a truck. She followed this truck. She tried to get a sample of the water. The driver had told her to stay away from the truck. And it was those anecdotal elements that made them think, okay, the puppy's sick. A couple months later, a horse dies. The Haneys lost a couple of animals. They lost a goat, a miscarried. All of these elements made them think, wait, whatever is sickening these animals may be behind the mysterious illnesses that we're feeling too.
Also, these deaths were unusual. I mean, on a farm, you're used to the life and the death of an animal. But some of these were particularly odd/gruesome.
They were horrifying. That's what I, too, you know, from the outsider point of view, was like, oh, come on, life and death is the nature of a farm. And in fact, the foaming at the mouth, I'm thinking of Jody, the death of one of the horses involved, the sicknesses that she incurred, the fits, were really horrific. And they really spoke to, most likely, according to the vet, a kind of metal poisoning. And again, this is where we get into really detail, because the metals associated with fracking are naturally occurring. They are in the soil already. It is the matter of shaking them loose that drilling often entails that then puts them into the water itself.
So what actually is being added then?
So how fracking works, like in a 1 second right. nutshell, you drill a mile or two down into the earth vertically. Then you drill out another mile or two. The distances are getting longer all the time with innovation. And into those holes, into those well bores, basically, you pump in millions of gallons of water, sand, and chemicals down into the hole vertically and then out so that what they do is fracture rock. They fracture ancient shale that was part of an inland seabed in Appalachia, in the Appalachian Basin. And when they fracture that rock, they free ancient bubbles of gas that are... they're carbon, right? They're made up of bodies and poo of ancient animals, okay? Leavings, right. We'll just say waste, yes. Okay? Then all of that comes back to the surface. Not all of it. Some of the wastewater remains in the ground. But when it comes back to the surface, it's bringing with it ancient bacteria and radioactive material in smaller or greater amounts.
I just want to touch on this before we go much further, because we are talking about fracking in this book. But you make the point to show us that this is the latest in a long line of whether it be timber or steel or coal, that these things have come to this part of the state and to this part of the country for a very long time.
I think that's the most frequently overlooked aspect of the story of fracking in America are the cycles of boom and bust industry in the same exact places. And what comes along with that is local people's very sophisticated understanding of the mineral rights beneath their land and of the sacrifices often called the give and take with these various industries, with extractive industries. So, for instance, in this case, you know, some outsiders would come and wag their fingers, environmentalists saying, why did you sign this lease? You know, you have imperiled your land. And many farmers would say to me, listen, longwall coal mining, a form of industrial coal mining, has taken the water and the farms in Prosperity, which is the name of the neighboring town, and maybe coming here. By signing this gas lease, I thought I was protecting my land against the coal company. So really understanding what the cost that rural Americans have paid for urban Americans for our energy really requires a historical understanding, especially in Appalachia.
Amity and Prosperity is the name of the book, One Family and the Fracturing of America. Eliza Griswold is the author. The book is published in paperback by Picador. Amity is about 6-8 miles from Prosperity.
10, give and take.
10?
Yeah.
About 40 miles, Amity, 40 miles south of Pittsburgh. You think of sprawl, but once you're out, if you don't know that area, even though you're relatively close to a city, you're out.
You are out. I mean, you know, in the book, references to Appalachia, I mean, just trying to be really careful as a reporter, especially with stereotypes, right? I kept saying, well, this isn't really Appalachia. This isn't Appalachia. And people in Amity and Prosperity would be like, who do you think you are? We are Appalachia. This is the beginning of Appalachia right here. Sometimes I call it Appalachian suburban reality, do you know, because this is, how do we get beyond these outdated ideas of what Appalachia is? I think in what we see, this, you know, so polarized world that we're living in now, especially the politics in America, being very precise, understanding that things don't really break down into the clean lines we think that they do is really an essential way to try to get to truth.
Also, we wouldn't have a lot of these stories if it wasn't for the decline of the family farm, right?
1,000,000%. And, you know, one of the, because I really made an effort, and people made an effort alongside me, even if they weren't so into this book, right, to allow me to report on them for years. Like, I'm thinking of Ray Day, a farmer who is to this day an adamant supporter of fracking. And what he would say if he were sitting here is he has a 300-acre family farm a few miles from Stacy's. And he would say, you know what? Fracking allowed me to put a roof on my barn. It allowed me to put a bathroom on the first floor of my farmhouse so that my mother could die at home. So I understand that it comes with costs, but it comes with personal benefits too. And some of those benefits have allowed people to hold on to farms when they wouldn't have been able to otherwise.
Meanwhile, the Haneys really didn't see any of the benefits.
They did not see any of the benefits at all. And I think what's happened, too, is that talking about the benefits is important because it is an accurate representation of the feelings that people have on the ground. It is also not something that is going to be borne out over time. The problems associated with fracking far outweigh its benefits.
So talk about the legal team that takes on the case of what eventually comes to the courts, because it is David versus Goliath, right?
Yeah. I mean, John and Kendra Smith are scrappy underdogs without whom I couldn't have written this book. Because although the story was incredibly compelling about people, the ability to drill into some of the facts associated with it were too daunting until John and Kendra Smith, who are no hand-wringing liberal environmentalists. Kendra is a corporate defense attorney who mostly defends railroads against asbestos claims. Like, she knows her P's and Q's, and that's a pretty expensive training that's gone into what she does, a lot of that with top industrial hygienists. So she has learned to read not only these water, like people in the book would often say, you know, Stacy and her neighbors, our water is contaminated, come out and test our water. The company would pay for it, right, for independent water testing, which how independent is it? Companies would come out and they would generate these really obfuscating reports. But when Kendra got involved, you know, Kendra is, she does not like when I talk about her physical nature. I'm maybe 5'3 on a good day. She's like 5 feet tall, maybe 100 pounds soaking wet. She lives on Coke and veggie sticks. I mean, she played Division I soccer throughout college. She is tough as nails. But she also has a scientific trap of a mind. So she would read raw data in a way that a scientist does, not a lawyer. So if she'd been a plaintiff attorney, I think she would have had to give this up a long time ago because she just wouldn't have had the skills necessary to break down some of the facts related to the case.
Obviously, when we say David versus Goliath, the Goliath here is Range Resources.
The Goliath is Range Resources, yes.
And when you look at them, they claim what?
Associated with this, they claim that most of this is played out in the courts, which is accurate,
right,
and that they have been found to not be responsible in most cases. There is also accuracy to that, in that the courts have made decisions largely not in the interests of the plaintiffs related to this case. And they have made some findings based on incomplete information that Range stands behind. So, okay. So they would say, first of all, the courts have found in our favor many times. That is true. They have stayed largely away from too much character assassination. I mean, there's been some. They have a lobbyist arm, energy and depth, it's called, that generates kind of nasty, like one of the people involved in the book, Buzz Kiskaden, who has since died of leukemia. They called him the junkyard plaintiff because he lived on a junkyard and, you know, put mugshots of his in their articles. It's a character assassination. And they did so, you know, when I wrote my first article for the New York Times Magazine about these people, they generated a statement called Griswold Goes to Pittsburgh, like out of Chevy Chase, you know, because right, that's the same name. That is what they, not Range necessarily, but that is what industrial interests do, right? They take on people who challenge them. And if the facts are too difficult to take on, they take on the character of those who are willing to stand up.
So you think of the way the system is set, and we have the protectors. So the protectors in this case would be the state and the Environmental Protection Agency.
Yeah.
And in theory, those are the people who are supposed to be at the side of the Haneys to say, all right, we'll get to the bottom of this.
Yep, that's exactly right.
So how does that fall through the cracks?
So in this case, I mean, when we talk about Kendra and John Smith, you know, when Kendra started digging into the facts related to this case, sure, corporate practice and malpractice was appalling. But that's what corporations do, right? Their commitment is to their shareholders and making profit as quickly as possible. So it wasn't shocking to her, misrepresentation and spills and leaks being covered up. What was shocking to her was the state's response. The Department of Environmental Protection, often called by Pennsylvanians Don't Expect Protection, that's the for the acronym, just failed at every front to safeguard Stacy and her neighbors. They found in favor of the company at every turn. They relied on data, even once data was debunked as being misleading, they relied on that data, as well as EPA testing methods that they then manipulated. In the interest of, I'm not going to ascribe an intention here, the result of the test methods they used is that they generated incomplete results. So they were testing for, in shorthand, like 24 different elements associated with fracking when they came out. That was what the EPA test mandated. I'm going to come out, test your water. I'm going to look for these 24 things associated with oil and gas. But when I type those test results into the computer, what I'm going to get is only partial results. It's too complicated to go into out loud, sure. I think. It's in the book in some specificity. I'm going to get results for about one third. So even if you've got all 24, I'm never going to know that, if that makes sense.
But also, we find out that then the company's trying to skew the results too.
The water laboratories are giving impartial results in the extreme, and the company is directing the laboratories to do so. The company is saying, for instance, hey, you know, there are low levels of X, Y, or Z in this water. Can you just put that they're an ND, they're not detectable since the levels are low? That kind of thing.
Then what protections are left?
Good question. What protections are left? So, okay, so then the feds come. Everybody gets excited. Federal investigators come in. They are going to launch. Now, they never, in the beginning, the federal investigators aren't sure what they're going to launch because they don't really know what's going on. One of the lead investigators now works for Chesapeake Energy, an oil and gas company. Mm-hmm. Others just failed to make the case that they were looking to make. And, you know, they would say, if they were here, one of them even said to John and Kendra Smith, if I fail to bring charges in this case, I'm going to give you my gun and my badge. You know, just implying that it was a slam dunk. And in the end, it wasn't. Now, what we found out as a result of the book and other factors for sure, Josh Shapiro, the attorney general in Pennsylvania, has launched an investigation into environmental crimes at this site and others. This came out through the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, which is now in court with Range over that. Range Resources then tried to take the Post-Gazette to hold them, I think, to subpoena the reporters for what were their sources on knowing this investigation was going on. So the case goes on. Not the settlement. The case has been settled, as I talk about, as a confidential settlement. And in fact, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette is in court right now trying to get this confidential settlement unsealed. And they have succeeded in the past in doing so in another fracking-related case.
What do you know of that settlement?
I know only what I can know. And since it's confidential, I don't know the terms. It is, reporters can report on the feelings people have.
Right.
I know that Stacey and her neighbors were disappointed. Kendra said to me early on in the reporting that, you know, everybody, when it comes to money and settlements, the idea in a plaintiff case is that you're going to be, quote, the legal language is to be made whole, right, at the end of it, and that money will never make anybody whole. So, there's disappointment and an inability to move on to this day. I mean, I'm still in touch with people. I see them quite regularly and continue to be floored by their integrity, their desire to move on and to leave this behind them.
You look back even to this time that you write about and the Obama administration, they were pro-fracking.
This was the Obama administration. And, you know, again, just any time we can kind of break down the nonsense of our polarized politics, you know, the black and white of it. Obama, you know, was all for, quote unquote, American energy independence, which Trump now calls, of course, energy dominance, but that's okay. And this all happened on his watch. His administration considered natural gas a, quote unquote, bridge fuel, right? That we were going to need natural gas to get from dirtier fuels, especially coal, to renewables. And the truth was that the market has proven that that's nonsense. Renewables are growing faster than any other form of fuel and we could have transitioned to renewables much more quickly if we didn't sort of buy the hype around natural gas.
But this is, without being overly cynical, but this is like one Obama thing that wasn't overturned by the Trump administration.
Yep. I mean, I think when you look at what the legacy of the Obama administration, where it falls down, I myself just look at the things that I've reported on, which are Syria and natural gas. fracking in particular. I mean, Obama saw natural gas as a potential jobs boom and a form of, you know, getting away from reliance on foreign oil. And again, in just making sure we're accurate, fracking does and has offered that, right? Like, fracking has offered a lack of dependence on foreign oil. Fracking has offered jobs in places where there weren't jobs before. But again, when you get down to the long-term costs and benefits, that equation changes. And the Obama administration simply wasn't looking long-term enough.
What was, say, New York State able to do in halting fracking that other states have not been able, one, and two, willing to do?
Yeah, because will is a huge part of it. Political will is what made New York able to do what Pennsylvania couldn't. And what New York has been able to do is basically ban fracking, right? Now, why could they do that? Really, to be honest, because Pennsylvania was such a glaring cautionary tale. And the activists involved in New York had so much evidence from Pennsylvania. I mean, they had the whole town of Dimmock that had lost its water, right? And New York activists were supplying water to a Pennsylvania town that had lost its water because of fracking contamination. So with armed with the evidence of especially water contamination, but other forms of social and health ills as well, New York was able to bring pressure on the Cuomo administration, New York activists, to ban fracking outright. And they were successful in doing so. And that made a huge difference in what, even what we've seen in Europe. We've seen European countries ban fracking, turn away from fracking. Even part of what the Obama administration was doing was trying to sell this technology worldwide. I mean, that's part of what Hillary Clinton was doing as Secretary of State, is she was on a rah-rah fracking mission around the world trying to export this technology.
So in our final moments, you have a lot of this scientific information now in your head, and you know this stuff. So what do you do with it now?
Okay, so there are two parts. There are the people,
right,
and there's the science,
yes,
right? So and then there is the responsibility of a prize like this. How do you use something like this to continue to shine light on the places that need it? That is where I am going first. The work that I'm doing now has to do with listening to Americans who we are not listening to in this divide between left and right. I see one of the things that has come out of this book is an ability to act as a translator of sorts. And that's what I'm trying to do first and foremost. After a couple of more projects like that, turning to the science, looking at pipelines, I keep reporting on the problems of pipelines, on what it means that Pennsylvania is going to become, you know, a natural gas hub and an industrial hub modeled on Texas and Louisiana. That's terrifying. And those stories, which are quiet horrors, again, hard to tell, miles underground, planning stages, those bear investigation. And that's the work I'll be doing.
The name of the book is Amity and Prosperity, One Family and the Fracturing of America. The book is published in paperback by Picador. It is the winner of the 2019 Pulitzer Prize for Nonfiction. Eliza Griswold, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much
for
your time.
Thank you so much, Joe. That was really fun.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Special thanks to Argo Studios in Manhattan. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.